Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. And today we're talking about the mimosa.
The mimosa in the first cocktail hour of 2019.
Ooh.
Yeah, and it's a good one to start the year off with.
Oh, yeah. It's what I started my year off drinking.
Is it?
It is, yeah.
I had sparkling wine minus the orange juice.
Oh, well, like the next morning. Yeah. Technically, it had grapefruit juice in it. Anyway.
We're getting into some technicalities here. But it's
technicalities.
Important. It is a tradition in my house that we would, me and my mom, no one else, but we would drink mimosas on New Year's Day, and we would have the traditional Southern New Year's meal.
Oh, peas and greens?
And ham.
And ham and cornbread.
We never did the cornbread.
No?
No. But I didn't realize until we did that episode that it makes more sense to have the cornbread in the theme of the meal. I like, it doesn't make sense at all, honestly, but
it's just delicious.
Yes, always. So, always. I did go through a very big mimosa phase in college. Very big. And when I was living in China, there was this American-themed restaurant under my apartment.
Okay.
And me and my friends, we were semi-regulars there. And they had these drinks you could order, American-sized, which meant that they came in these metal buckets, like big metal buckets. And the two drinks you could get this way were a rum and coke and a mimosa. And I would drunkenly claim to everyone that this was my serving of fruit for the day. But drink responsibly, everybody.
drink responsibly. Yes. Oh, that's a big theme of this episode, actually.
It is. It is. And also, I recently went to Mimosa Fest in Atlanta.
I'm still horrified by the entire concept of this.
Well, it's really funny because I was hanging out with you and Dylan before at like a mimosa brunch.
Yes.
To prepare for Mimosa Fest.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I was pleasantly surprised by the turnout. It was much more diverse than I thought it was going to be. I thought it was going to be, like, college-age white people.
Yeah.
And there was such a range of mimosa-themed T-shirts. It was so good. My favorite one was obviously the Harry Potter one. It's mimosa, not mimosa. and I feel kind of silly, but I had no idea that people had such strong opinions and passion about mimosas. The police had to shut the festival down because we were dancing too much, too wildly.
You know,
they reopened it. They just wanted everybody to, like, take a minute.
Chill out.
The Beyonce music was getting us too wild.
Yeah, you can have too much fun on mimosas, as it turns out.
I suppose that is a wise lesson of this episode.
But yeah, that brings us to our question.
Mimosas.
What?
That's all we have. When you start drinking the mimosas, then your sentences get
They do shorter, get a little bit shorter. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, a mimosa is a cocktail traditionally made with sparkling wine and orange juice. The International Bartenders Association says it's equal parts of each, though you can make it, you know, heavy on either the sparkling or the juice to your preference. Dry wines are usually used to offset the sweetness of the juice. There is apparently controversy about whether you should use pulpy or strained orange juice.
Mimosa controversy.
I like a little bit of pulp. I mean, come on. It's like a salad.
Yeah, it's your fruit serving of the day. I'm on board.
And the result of all of this is a bright, fresh-tasting drink. It's citrusy and sweet and tingly and a little bit sour and, yeah.
Yeah, it's nice and refreshing.
It is.
The name comes to us thanks to a flower called what? The mimosa! Surprise. It's native to Mexico and Central and South America, and its blossom is bright yellow or orange. Like the drink. Makes sense. Or some other places I read it's named after the Australian shrub that was popular among French gardeners, which would make sense that the name came from there. History, mystery, we've said it before.
Mysteries of history.
But how do you make one?
Well, basically, you mix orange juice and Lauren. Sparkling wine. Okay. Well, all right. Squeezing fresh juice really does make a difference in this drink because it is so simple. And fresh orange juice is so lovely. What I like to use, I've got one of those handheld hinged citrus pressers.
Yeah.
It's a little bit messy, but you can get a good one for like under 15 bucks, and they're so easy to use. You don't have to plug anything into a wall socket.
Mm-hmm.
Strain your juice if you want to. Chill both it and a bottle of sparkling wine. For that wine, get something you wouldn't mind drinking on its own.
Yeah, that just makes sense.
It does. It does. And again, probably go for something dry. Dry as opposed to sweet. It's not like dry wines have like less water content or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Or I don't know, if you have a sweeter palate, go for a sweeter sparkle. That's nice too. Do what you want.
Yeah. You do you.
Mm-hmm. Proseccos and cavas tend to be on the drier side and less expensive for the quality, in my personal experience. And reminder of the episode, if you're going for a dry sparkle, look for the words brut or extra brut on the label. That indicates a dry sparkling wine. Confusingly, sparkling wine that's labeled dry or extra dry is sweeter than brut and extra brut. No one asked me when they were making these label designations.
They should have.
I know.
You know, I was recently, I was perusing sparkling wine section at a local liquor store, which, by the way, the parking lot for that liquor store had four cops directing traffic in it before New Year's Day.
Is this Greens?
Yes!
Right by the, oh, man.
I like to sit and watch people just try to park there because I'm mean-spirited. But I forgot. Our first episode was on sparkling wine, and I got confused by the labels. I was like, I'm pretty sure it doesn't make any sense. So it's got to be the one I don't think it is. Would it be ridiculous to look up our episode notes?
Never.
Never. I could just type it in the internet, but no. I'll go back to the research.
Go back to your own research. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
When you're actually making it, I like to add the juice to the glass and then pour the sparkling wine on top of it because the action of the bubbles kind of stirs it for you. You don't have to mess with stirring it.
Yeah.
For extra chill factor, chill the glass beforehand or add an ice cube. No one's going to tell you not to. Well,
if
some
they
people
do, then
yeah. Also, speaking about the price of sparkling wines and what you're comfortable drinking on its own, I found this New York Times article about champagne cocktails, and it recommended treading, quote, a middle path in quality and price, $40 to $50.
Ooh.
And I was like, that's your middle path. That's my, goodness my gracious.
Mm-hmm.
There are just a number of different kinds of humans in this world.
There really are. That's true. I once spent, I bought a bottle. No, I didn't. I got someone to buy me a bottle of Uve Coco. And then I once spent $40 on one glass of wine. But it was a glass I'd been meaning to try forever, and I didn't order dinner. I was like, well, no food, but I will take one glass of this. And I'm glad I did.
Well, drink responsibly.
Yeah. I mean, one glass.
One glass.
Lauren.
Oh, that's absolutely fine. Spend your money on what you want. Variations of mimosas. There are so many of these.
Yes. Insert any fruit juice variation here. At Mimosa Fest, you could go up and you would say, like, I want pineapple juice, mango juice. There are so many juices to put into your mimosa, which then technically, is it a mimosa?
Or is it a different thing? Is it a Bellini, perhaps?
A Bellini, which replaces the orange juice with peach juice.
Mm-hmm.
Poinsettia, which is the holiday take with cranberry juice. You've got your grand mimosa with a dash of orange liqueur. A Valencia with apricot liqueur.
Add a dash of bitters. Add a dash of an orange Amaro, like a Campari or Aperol. If you're making one alcohol-free with juice and sparkling water, I'd add like a little bit of lime or lemon juice and like a half an ounce of simple syrup to help balance it out. I don't know, maybe a pinch of salt even, like experiment. See what
Ooh,
you like.
I like the idea of some salt in there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about some mimosa numbers?
Apparently, as of 2018, according to Google search data, the mimosa was the most popular cocktail in California, Maryland, North Carolina, and this our home state of Georgia.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. I don't know what I would have thought it was, but I wouldn't have said the mimosa.
No, according to Google searches, I think that the popularity of brunch has something to do with that.
Yeah, and speaking of brunch, let's talk about The bottomless mimosa.
Oh, my goodness. These are, if you've never seen it advertised, this is a relatively popular thing that is advertised on brunch menus, like bottomless mimosa, as many as you can put in your face for 2 hours for only $15.
Right.
Yeah. They are considered a loss leader by the restaurants that offer them. They are risking serving mimosas at or even below cost in order to bring customers in and hopefully then make up the difference on other menu items either during that meal or on repeat visits.
Yeah. I will say that I've noticed, as someone who's experienced many a bottomless mimosa brunch, I have noticed in the past couple of years that it went from bottomless to like five, or you know, like there's a number
there's
or
like
a time limit attached to it now. It used to be like, have at it, friends, but then I think
friends had at it.
And I think we did.
Yeah,
I was like, I must get my money's worth and more. They're like, oh, please leave.
Anecdotally, I read that it might be more like business peer pressure than actual business savvy or like any kind of like noticeable like number profit that is making people offer bottomless mimosas. Like, well, they're doing it. Heck.
We gotta compete with them.
Yeah. And they're really only a thing in the United States, Canada, and the UK. Other places do have bottomless brunch. But again, according to Google search data, like there's not that much buzz about bottomless mimosas.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah. I mean, they're fun. I have heard that, and I'm actually probably this is totally true, that you're getting like very weak mimosas.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's probably made with like André.
Yeah.
Which is fairly bottom of the barrel. I mean, yeah, you're probably not getting a good sparkling wine. You're probably not getting good orange juice.
But it is bottomless.
One restaurateur in Michigan reported to Eater that she cuts people off after 8 glasses.
8 glasses, okay.
That's her number.
What if it's, ooh, okay, never mind. I'm trying to game the system and I shouldn't.
You don't have to. You're doing just okay. National Mimosa Day is May 16th.
Oh, that's nice. The weather's all spring, and at least here in the mm-hmm. Northern Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
There is a Manhattan beer garden named Hofbräu Beer House in New York City, and it has a 100-ounce mimosa tower.
Okay, I was curious about this. Uh-huh. I needed to look further into it, so I did. Have you ever seen a beer tower?
I have.
Yeah. It's that, but they put mimosa in it. You know, it's a clear glass or plastic cylinder, like 3.5 feet tall, filled with beverage, spigot at the base. And if you're bad at ounces, like I am, a single serving of mimosa is probably like 6 to 8 ounces. So a tower of this size has 12 to 16 servings or thereabouts.
Enjoy with friends.
Brian O'Connor, writing for Extra Crispy, said of it, "There are societal obligations involved in finishing 100 ounces of mimosa. The novelty begins to fade somewhere near the bottom of the tower, and your hopes and dreams become as scattershot as the trail of orange pulp left behind in the tube of beverage above your table, one pour at a time. But even as you feel your constitution fade, your determination increases. You realize just how valuable your friends are, how much you love them, and why they're the greatest."
I love that.
Yeah.
That sounds like the new year to me.
I know, right?
It's like encapsulated. That's what happens. The mimosa. Perfect drink for the new year.
It is. And we've got some history for you. But first, we've got a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you. And since it's cocktail hour, it's time for multiple legends of the who, what, when, where of the mimosa.
Yes.
There are a lot of them.
There are.
One version goes that the mimosa owes its existence to a drink invented in 1921 at the Buck's Club in London called the Buck's Fizz by its inaugural bartender, Pat McGarry. It was a combination of orange juice and sparkling wine, but the ratio was more skewed towards the sparkling wine as opposed to the orange juice.
Two parts sparkling wine to one part juice.
And Buck, by the way, refers to a family of drinks that calls for ginger ale. I did not know that.
Yeah, and ginger ale, I think meaning the alcoholic stuff, which, by the way, has sometimes been called ginger champagne.
That sounds so fancy.
I know.
Champagne. Okay, so if we continue along with this story, then this drink went on to inspire a bartender named Frank Meyer at the Ritz Hotel in Paris in 1925 to create a drink with equal parts orange juice and sparkling wine, the mimosa.
Yeah, a juice of half of an orange, an equal amount of sparkling wine, and an ice cube.
Oh, originally came with an ice cube.
It did, yeah.
All right. A lot of drink historians doubt that Meyer invented this drink. A recipe for the mimosa was in his 1934 book of cocktails called The Artistry of Mixing Drinks. And the book contained 300 recipes, but yes, the mimosa was in there. Each recipe that Meyer claimed to have invented himself, though, came with a symbol featuring his initials next to it, and no symbol appears next to the entry for the mimosa.
Ah.
Yes.
The first time a recipe for the mimosa appeared in print, by the way, was in Harry Craddock's 1930s The Savoy Cocktail Book. And I think it was called a Buck's Fizz in there.
A Buck's Fizz. But in 1959, the London Observer cast doubt on the origin of the Buck Fizz story, too. Quote, one London club likes to regard this as a specialty of the house and calls it Buck's Fizz. But under its native name of Champagne Orange, it has been drunk by many a Frenchman whom Bucks would blackball on sight. My goodness. And when I was thinking about it, it does seem likely to me that the Champagne Orange, as it was called, would have come from wine country, and specifically Champagne country in France. I mean, not necessarily, but it makes sense.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bartenders at these swankier establishments might have given them a new name, but they had probably been enjoyed before then.
Oh, sure. As with many cocktails, you know.
Somebody popularizes it.
Yes.
And then they get all the credit. That was an excellent face you just made.
Meanwhile, the Bellini may have originated in the 1930s in Venice at a place called Harry's Bar.
I remember specifically the first time I had a Bellini.
Yeah?
And I was in New York, and I was traveling with one of my friend's families, and she has a, you know, we've all got one, the really rich relative.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In her case, it was her aunt, and she lives in New York, and, like, she was so rich. She took us into Tiffany's to look at that. Like, that was the place she took tourists from nowhere, Georgia. Let's go look at Tiffany's.
Let's go into Tiffany's.
And we were like, we don't belong in here. We've got to get out.
Shouldn't touch anything. Yeah.
And I said she was asking what everyone wanted to eat. And I was like, pizza or New York. And she gave me this look like, we're not going anywhere near pizza. What are you talking about? So we went to this really nice restaurant on Central Park. And I went to order a mimosa, and she was like, you should get a Bellini. And I had no idea what it was, but I'm like, okay.
You're like, all right. This lady knows what she's talking about.
I felt so fancy with my Bellini. It was good, and I wasn't paying, so that was extra good. But we go back to the mimosa. Its popularity got a significant boost in the United States during the 1960s thanks to the British royalty.
Okay.
Yeah.
Sure.
In 1961, the Sydney Morning Herald reported, quote, the royal family has begun a new fad in drinks among London's fashionable Mayfair set. The Queen, the Duke of Edinburgh, and the Queen Mother all have adopted a champagne cocktail they call the mimosa. And then if they're doing it,
yeah,
we got to do it,
if too. If it's good enough for the Queen Mother.
I suppose it's good enough for me. Earl Mountbatten of Burma gets the credit for introducing the Queen to the drink after a visit to France. And it did not take long for the rest of the royal family to start sipping mimosas. However, they weren't really drinking it in the morning, but it was something that they would enjoy before they sat down to dinner.
As of 1965, food columnist Poppy Cannon wrote, even in the most sophisticated quarters, you will be considered exceptionally knowledgeable if you order a mimosa.
Oh, how times have changed. Mimosas had another famous fan in director Alfred Hitchcock. In a 1966 article in the London Express, the author describes how when he arrived to interview Hitchcock, he was, quote, in fine form drinking mimosas. This article was reprinted all over the United States. And when Hitchcock paid New York a visit later that same year after this article had circulated, one observer wrote that he, quote, paused to serve mimosa cocktails, a mixture of champagne and fresh orange juice. When I first started researching this episode, one of the first things that came up, I think because it's fun, a story less than it's actually true, but that was that he invented the mimosa in San Francisco in the 1940s. And I find that highly, 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 highly unlikely. But I did find that in more than one place.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Huh.
Again, he probably just helped make it popular.
Make it popular, sure. Another person who helped make it popular was Elizabeth Taylor, who is said to have broken her fasts with bacon, eggs, and mimosas.
Mm. Vanessa Redgrave also was described drinking mimosas during her stay in New York, which an article described as, quote, her pet mixture of bubbly and orange juice. French actress Denise Darcel also spoke to the press about mimosas, telling the Detroit Free Press, in France, we drink mimosa. Lots of star power behind this drink.
Yeah, yeah. All of these names kept coming up. Marion Davies, Trevor Howard. I love it.
Yeah. And we talked in our episode around brunch about how celebrities helped put these drinks in the zeitgeist as brunch drinks during Prohibition when they wanted to drink something in the morning in public that could be mistaken for juice, not juice with some type of alcohol in there.
Right, right. Yeah. Give me tomato juice with vodka. It's a Bloody Mary. Thank you.
Exactly.
Or, yes, mimosas.
Another theory goes that perhaps the mimosa was invented by an American film director for Marilyn Monroe in the 1940s. Again, probably not. But she did like them and claimed to drink them every morning.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. However, Americans largely took after the Europeans at first, drinking mimosas in the evenings or even in nightclubs. Quote, the dancing crowd cool themselves off with mimosas.
That is not what I want when I'm dancing.
I have done that before.
Oh, geez.
Back in my early college, my mimosa phase. I was ordering mimosas, like, at clubs. What a fool. Oh, anyway, yeah, we all have to go through that foolish drink stage.
We do. Mine involved mudslides, and I have regrets.
I what did I like? White Russians.
Oh,
White Russian
yeah.
screwdrivers and mimosas.
Oh, geez.
Oof, yes.
Well, while we say thanks for being older and wiser now, we're going to take one more quick break for a word from our sponsor and come back with a little bit more mimosa history.
And we're back. Thank you, sponsor.
Yes, thank you.
So, okay, how did the mimosa become a brunch drink? This is a great question. It kind of seems obvious because we talked about in our orange episode, orange juice is a breakfast-associated drink. But it actually took a bit longer than I might have suspected anyway.
Yeah. As of a New York Times article in 1966, the Bloody Mary was the classic brunch cocktail. It did say that the Bloody Mary had a number of unexpected competitors, including everything from double martinis. People got up to some stuff in the 60s, y'all. to banana daiquiris, to the champagne orange.
Aye. Mm-hmm. Those are some unexpected contenders, I gotta say. But if we trace back the mimosa to its brunch roots in the United States, we find ourselves in New Jersey. Oh, my gosh.
We've so rarely found ourselves there.
Yeah, that's true. That's, you know what? It's about time.
It is.
It was fall 1968. An article from the Asbury Park Press's Nightlife Roundup summed up the journey of the mimosa thusly. It started as a favorite of the Caribbean jet set, then hit elite New York clubs, and now is featured at the Shandy Pub, Point Pleasant Beach. According to the Shandy Pub, they introduced the mimosa into their brunch lineup for folks that couldn't handle the, quote, rough stuff in the morning. The practice spread slowly at first. In 1971, you could find a champagne brunch at North Bergen's The Point Cocktail Lounge, which did feature mimosas. And I got to fill out the scene here.
Okay.
Because when I hear The Point Cocktail Lounge, I'm picturing kind of a, you know, it's going for something really classy, but it just doesn't succeed.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Maybe this is correct then. The Point Cocktail Lounge was a football-themed club decked out with football helmet lampshades and artificial turf.
What?
And mimosas.
That's great.
Isn't it?
I want to go to there.
I do too. when I read that, because I was just kind of like, oh, yeah, Point Club, whatever. Wait a minute. Football lampshades. AstroTurf. I've got to get there now.
Okay, back to the 60s, back to the late 60s, early 70s. Note that this was the era when brunch was becoming a thing in the United States. Like, social mores were changing. Prior to the 1940s, it was considered inappropriate for a woman to drink in public or during the day at all, even in her own kitchen. By the 1960s, brunch cocktails were acceptable for everyone, and it was an era of great economic growth for the middle classes. You know, like, brunch was rising up as this, like, bougie status thing. In places like New York City, for example, like a C&B scene, or a relatively affordable indulgence. See our brunch episode, Much Do About Brunch, from April of 2017 for more on all of that.
Yes. The brunch mimosa truly arrived in New York by 1977. A New York Times writer stopped at 40 brunch places in Manhattan as part of a piece she was working on, and she wrote about some of her favorite drinks, including, quote, that champagne and orange juice combination known as the mimosa, occasionally laced with brandy as well. It's around this time that mimosas became more and more common on brunch menus across the United States. It has solidified its place among brunch drinks by the 1980s. And speaking of the 80s, if we go back to the UK, the Buck Fizz experienced a resurgence of popularity during that decade thanks to the availability of pre-mixed bottles at supermarkets.
Huh. Man, America has never really gotten in on the whole pre-mixed bottles of stuff thing.
No. Yeah, every time I go to Europe and I'm like, wait a minute, this is just a gin and tonic and like a juice bottle?
But it's in a can? Yeah. Okay. Sure. In 2009, the Pantone color of the year was 140848, called Mimosa.
Oh, so, you know, I didn't know this was a thing until everybody made a big deal about it this year.
Oh, yeah, no, it's great. I love color, and that was a really basic thing to say out loud into a microphone. I love color. No, but I do. I love discussion of color psychology and in the fashion industry. I think it's super fascinating stuff. And mimosa was or still is, this bright, warm, kind of egg yolky yellow, meant to be hopeful and radiant. Quote from their press release, in a time of economic uncertainty and political change, optimism is paramount, and no other color expresses hope and reassurance more than yellow.
I had to think about that for a second. I guess so. I suppose. Yeah, it's like a sun rising.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Nice and bright.
Yes. Well, speaking of maybe not so bright.
Speaking of hope and reassurance.
The bottomless mimosa.
Oh, goodness. Okay. According to Google Trends, we are living in the peak popularity of bottomless mimosa. After its use as a search term had been slowly increasing from the first pings in January of 2006.
Oh.
Yeah.
So that's pretty recent.
Yeah. To be fair, the Google Trends data only goes back to 2004.
Oh,
and
yeah.
The way that people use searches certainly can mean a lot of different things. But
yeah.
It's an interesting data point that you could use as a discussion of how people use the internet to look for brunch specials or how many people are serving bottomless mimosas. Either one.
Right.
Or both.
Mm-hmm.
Bottomless brunch, meanwhile, dates as far back as Google Trends goes. And we are also living in the peak of that. What a time to be alive.
Indeed.
Yeah, both really started picking up around 2012. I want to put in here that for 3 days in 2014, the New York City Hospitality Alliance caused a mild panic when it blogged about an obscure bit of legal code that could have affected the bottomless mimosa. As it turns out, the New York State Liquor Authority technically prohibits unlimited drink specials spanning a particular period of time for a fixed price.
Oh, no.
Twitter was mad.
Twitter's always mad.
But yeah, the State Liquor Authority came to the rescue with a blessed and appropriate haste. They cited a subcode that allows bottomless drinks to be sold during events.
Oh, so brunch is an event.
Yeah.
I mean, it is kind of. If you can get people together and then you got to wait in line 3 hours.
Right?
Yeah.
That's an event.
It is. It is.
And also in 2014, one Manhattan brunch spot called Prana, was put on probation by the local community board because of its bottomless mimosas. Like, its customers were too unruly too frequently when they spilled out of the restaurant into the surrounding neighborhood. And eventually the store's liquor license was suspended. And when they finally got it back, they took bottomless mimosas off the menu.
Well, it sounds like they learned their lesson. You know? At least they didn't try again.
I don't know. I'm not sure. I feel like, you know, lessons being learned is great.
Mm-hmm.
There's part of me that's like,
what a beautiful, wonderful mess it must have been. Just epic.
Like, how bad did it have to have been?
To get a probation? Oof. I'm kind of curious.
Bottomless mimosas, y'all.
Oh, yeah. Maybe one of our listeners will, maybe they experienced this this place. This has been a fun episode. I didn't realize how many memories I have. Most of them Harry Potter related, with a mimosa. Me and my roommate used to watch Harry Potter movies, like, through different years, and we would drink mimosas. And I actually rewatched all the Harry Potter movies this year because I have this weird... I have to watch certain movies that have to be my last movie, my first movie of the new year. And I did it with mimosas, and I didn't even realize it, that I'm continuing this tradition. And we weren't together, but we were, like, texting each other as we watched them together.
That's so sweet.
It was great. And I'm getting a little like, oh, man. Those were fun times. I mean, I made some mistakes, but they were fun times.
Lessons being learned.
Yes, all around. But this brings us to the end of this episode, into the beginning of
Listener Mail.
Yes. Yeah. Brittany wrote, the reason I'm writing is that I'm reading through The Little Book of Higa by Mike Wiking. Oh, gosh, Danish. And I came across a short passage about Danish birthday celebrations. According to him, it is traditional at children's birthday parties to create a cake man, which is like a large gingerbread man made of sweet dough, decorated with sweets and the Danish flag. Quote, part of the tradition is that the birthday boy or girl cuts the throat of the cake man while the other kids scream, which is the most metal thing I've ever heard. And it got me thinking about birthday food traditions in other countries and cultures, and I think it would be such a fun topic for you guys to do a deep dive in. Yes, that is amazing.
That took a turn.
Right? I was just like, oh, birthday cake. Whoa! I am determined to learn more about this.
Okay.
I hope it's true.
Cake man.
There is a, you know, like if you did Always Sunny in Philadelphia, like Night Man, Day Man, but with Cake Man.
Cake Man.
There is a song parody there. Just waiting.
In the meanwhile, Kevin wrote, I just wanted to say thanks for getting to latkes recently. Listening to the episode filled me with memories of Hanukkah with my family and the plates piled high with latkes. Lauren, you are right on with the sour cream and applesauce combo. Thank you. Though, to be honest, there is no wrong way to latke. The twist on our family recipe was that we also used some onions in with the potatoes. I remember being about 8 or 9 when I was able to take my turn on our big old hand crank grinder that we used to process the onions and potatoes. At the time, this was a step on par with sitting at the adult table. That grinder has been in the family for at least 2 generations before me, and as time has passed, the grinder has passed to me. Now it's my responsibility to make the latkes every year. I'm also excited to know that there will be a 4th generation to pass it on to with my new daughter who celebrated her first Hanukkah this year. And he included a picture. Yeah. And, oh, congratulations.
Yes.
And that is so sweet.
I know. I love it. I love this, the hand grinder being the equivalent of the,
yeah,
the adult table.
Oh, no. I see you. It's a, they're cool little gadgets. I like them.
Huh. I have so much to explore this world of latkes. Very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to both of them for writing in. If you would like to write to us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
We're also on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SaverPod. We hope to hear from you.
Thank you, as always, to our super producers, Dylan Fagan and Andrew Howard. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.
You realize just how valuable your friends are.